Hi, this is Circe Olson Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is a podcast from the museum's Veteran Family Community Collaborative. It's been a while since we've done a podcast from the VFCC, but this topic is very important, and so we want to spend a few moments talking about loss and grief and, how to talk to your kids about difficult topics. Of course, each situation is different. The opinions shared on this podcast won't work for everyone, but we hope that the listener might get some useful tips. My guest today is Dr. Natalie Williamson, and she's a psychologist and a mom and has both personal and professional experience around these topics. And I'm very glad she came on the show today. Hi, Natalie.
Hey, Cersei, glad to be back.
So, Natalie, I just wanted to start this conversation by talking about loss. Loss has many meanings, and in a military family, our kids and the military family has a lot of loss, but it's not always in the sense that most people would expect. But it's precisely the multiple little cuts of loss adding up to something quite substantial. Like moving, like when you move, then you get some of your household goods or favorite toys or items, they go missing or get broken. And then every time military families move, the family loses friends and the kids have to go to new schools. And of course, this adds up. It happens to every family who moves, but it happens regularly and often for military families. Like my own family moved 18 times in 20 years. And so I just wanted to talk a little bit about, loss, but also, to get some practical advice for parents. We parents sometimes see this big adventure of a new job and a new location, and we forget our kids are dealing with it too, and they may not see it the same way we do. And so my question is, what would you say to a parent who's getting ready for a major event, such as a move, or has just done one, and the child seems very upset or confused about it?
Cersei, I think that's a really good question. I think number one, communication is key. I think prompting children, letting them know what's happen, really assuring them that there's going to be different emotions that they might be feeling, and that also the whole family's feeling and dealing with. So just letting them know that, anger, confusion, being worried, being scared, that all of that is normal and that everybody is feeling it. But I think definitely communicating with them from day one about what everything that is going on, and that, everyone's in it together and they're working together, and checking in with them as well regularly. Not just bringing it up once and then, never, talking about it again. But I think just kind of prompting them and giving those, that reassurance is, something that's helped them to get through that.
Well, so what did like, we're talking about reassurance, but what advice do you have for the parents who are super stressed and they're struggling? I mean, they'd like to be reassured that the new move or job, they need some comforting themselves, and yet, they're supposed to reassure their child, but they may not be feeling it. Is there any self-care a parent can do? What do you think?
Absolutely. I'm a big advocate of honesty is the best policy with your children. But I think it's also the way you present that honesty. If the adults, are feeling very worried and stressed out, I mean, yes, they want to be honest with their children that that is, the emotions that maybe they're going through, and but they really want to talk about those true feelings with other, people around them that may, understand or know what they're going through or what they're feeling. So they really want to, utilize other people that they know can assist them, to get through that, whether that's, colleagues or family or, other adults. And so when they're doing it with their children, they really want to do that more at a kid-friendly level. But as far as self-care goes, I think it's really depends on each individual. They really need to know their limits and their boundaries with themselves. And so if they need, you know, to get away for a couple of days, or they need to talk to a therapist briefly, or they need to talk to a family member, or just, you know, get away for a day just to gather their thoughts, then they need to do that. So yes, you know, be honest with their children and their families, but you know, at the same time, they need to do all of that within reason, and you know, go to the people that they know can help support them, but at those age appropriate levels, if that makes any sense.
So that sounds good. So like if an adult is feeling overwhelmed, they should reach out to one of their friends or family members to work through that, or like you said, a therapist, or just to, you know, get some time out.
Right.
And so that sounds really helpful to just be able to call a friend and vent for a little bit, or say, you know, hey, I've made a mistake. Tell me it's okay. You know, just like
a kid
wants to. So is it helpful for a parent to say to their child, I'm stressed and I'm struggling and I'm worried too? Or should they keep a stiff upper lip so not to frighten their child more?
No, I think it is helpful to say that. Mm-hmm. But again, it needs to be, you know, done in a kid-friendly manner where still your children still feel safe, you know. So it needs to be done in a manner where, you know, you're presenting it. It's the way you present it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to present it and you're all anxious and nervous and, you know, you're just really falling apart and you're crying for hours and hours, then yeah, that's going to really worry your children. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing it in a manner where you're like, you know, I do feel this as well, but don't worry, we're going to get through this, and we've got other people to support us, and I'm reaching out to others, and, you know, just, you know, I think, if you do it in a more well-rounded manner, mm-hmm. But yet you're honest, you know, it's, you know, your children are going to understand that. They're going to be able to relate to that. And I think it's also, it's good skills for them to learn. So that way, as they get older, they'll be better able to problem solve and handle those situations, because they may be in those very same situations when they get older, when they have their own children as well.
Yeah, so kind of role model.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it seems like the world today expects everybody just to change fast and be resilient and adopt the attitude of suck it up and drive on. And, you know, some people just can't, or maybe they shouldn't. Maybe we're not supposed to bounce like rubber bands, you know, after some difficult event. What do you think? Suck it up or drive on, or be resilient?
I think you said it in the beginning, Circe. You mentioned that there's different situations and there's, you know, different responses and, you know, different things that go on. I think every situation is going to be different. So I think, you know, it's good to let children know that some situations you may actually be able to bounce back a lot quicker, you know, and, you know, regardless of whatever society thinks. Mm-hmm. But then there's going to be other situations where maybe you're not, you know, especially when you're dealing with losses and grief and losses. And, you know, those things take time. And I think it's good to let children know that it does and that it's all right. And just, you know, let them know that, you know, sometimes you are going to bounce back and there's going to be other times where it's going to be longer. Now, when you're looking at really extensive amount of times where, you know, you're just, you know, not bouncing back at all, that's where, you know, there's going to be some concerns where, you know, that's where the parent or the adults are going to need to, you know, say, all right, it's been, you know, 6 months, a year. Now we need to take a look at this where, you know, this is a problem. But yeah, I think really normalizing things and just letting them know that society is going to say lots of different things, but everybody's reactions and feelings and everything that people experience in their selves and their families, that's all going to be really individual based. And I think it's good to remind them that all that's going to be individual based. What works for one might not work for another. And what might work in one situation might not work in a different situation.
Right.
And so it's good to let them know about all that.
Okay. All right. So just talking to you sounds so reassuring.
You're reassured now, Cersei.
Yeah, I'm reassured.
You're reassured in our conversation.
So what kind of reassurance can we as parents give our kids if they are not making friends in school or they feel like nothing is going right in their lives? You know, as a parent, I always felt really sad when my kids weren't quite meshing in their schools. They were struggling in class. They didn't have friends yet because they were just new to the system. And I didn't really know what to do or say. It seemed like saying platitudes like, they don't know how wonderful you are, or give it time, or, you know, if they were struggling in class, you know, you need to study more. It doesn't seem to be really very helpful.
Well, you know, that's a tough one, Cersei, because new environments for everybody on both ends is not easy, especially kids, you know, in the school system, you know, whether they're children or they're adolescents, and kids in general. I think humans in general, we all want to be able to just fit in. And when you go somewhere new, you don't exactly know, you know, where that is. And if you're, and sometimes there's going to be, you know, some situations where they may fit in right away, and then others where it may take longer, or they may never. And so really it's just, I think, you know, reminding children that, you know, everybody's got different personalities, and everybody's got, you know, different interests, and really you need to take that time to listen to others and really see what their perspectives are. And then, you know, also hopefully they have, you know, they're secure in themselves where they know what their interests are and their perspectives are, and they'll gravitate towards the individuals that have more similarities towards them. But it does take a little bit of time. And if you don't see that they are making any connections at all, you know, that's maybe where sometimes I recommend parents that, you know, if kids just aren't making any connections in their school and they're new and they're not fitting in, I recommend that they go over there and observe. Like, they ask the teacher to go in a day and just sort of observe what's going on. And you kind of really then need to intervene more if, you know, those relationships don't seem to be developing, and really working with teachers and the administration as to, you know, what's going on with those relationships.
Well, you know, that's really amazing that you say that, because that's something that some parents might find difficult going into the school, observing or having a conversation, especially if the parents are concerned that the kid's not doing well and wants to talk to the teacher. You know, sometimes though, the teacher may be noticing things and call the parents in, and the dynamics might be different. So how can a parent prepare for a meeting with their child's teacher, or suggest that they want to come observe? And especially if they're concerned with the child's emotional well-being, you know, especially if the parent or the teacher feels something's not right, but they can't put their finger on it. So how can parents prepare for these meetings, or what should they be looking for or thinking about?
You know, what I usually recommend parents, and I do this in, you know, with my own children, is I recommend communicating with the teacher from the very beginning. So from the beginning of that school year, from those first meetings, you know, I always recommend go to those open houses, or whatever the teacher invites are in the beginning, mm-hmm. or the school invites. Really go and meet them, you know, whether you're doing that in person or virtually now, because now in the school system, a lot of, you know, systems are just, they're doing things only virtually now. But really do that and really make those connections from the beginning, and let them know, let the teacher know, that have an open communication with them and say, you know, tell the teacher, let me know if anything's going on academically, socially, behaviorally, emotionally, you know, really let them know that you're actively engaged. And sometimes I even recommend if there are issues, you know, like especially if it's a military family with a new move, you might want to check in with teacher once a week, you know, whether that's just through an email or something, just to, or if you're able to see them once a week when you pick them up or drop at pickup or drop off. But really, I find that that communication is key. And hopefully the teacher is receptive. And if you get a teacher that isn't receptive, because, you know, sometimes high school level, I find that some of those teachers are more closed off. They're like, well, you know, they're young men or young women and they need to, you know, do it on their own and you can't be, you know, baiting them along. When that happens, sometimes what I'll do is I will, you know, if I need to, I'll, you know, connect with the administrators and then have them sort of be my mediator if I have concerns. So again, you know, always talking with them, whether it's the teachers or the administrators, but keep that open line of communication. So if there comes a day where you do want to go and observe, then you feel comfortable to be able to ask that. And the teacher as well will feel comfortable with you coming in.
Yeah, you're not just springing something on them.
Right.
It sounds like building relationships from the very beginning, supportive relationships.
Yes.
And that's good advice. Don't wait until you think there's a problem. Go, you know, just always be there and willing to help, volunteering at the school probably too, or just, you know, checking in with the teacher as you, like you said, when you pick up your child.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I have another question. You know, this has been a lot of on the news lately about bullying. What are some signs to look for if your students might be bullied at school? And also, what are some reasons that some kids may be bullying other children? And what can we as parents do about that?
Oh my gosh, Susie, that's a whole other podcast now.
Yeah.
But no, here's the short answer though, if this is a short answer. So reasons for bullying, you know, there's a lot. I've always, you know, when I interview bullies, that the students that are actually doing the bullying, usually there's a lot of insecurities. You know, they're angry about something else in their life that's going on, and they take it out on others, and they just got this anger, you know, and they, you know, bring that on to others for whatever reason. But there's usually, you know, different reasons. It's like an onion. It's layers, you know, there's usually layers behind it. And so unfortunately, these victims of, you know, the bullying, the victimization, I mean, you know, I think if it's sometimes the signs and symptoms are, you can see them right away, because let's say one, you know, your child is happy and bubbly, and then suddenly the next school year, they're very different. You know, they're isolated and they're withdrawn and they're in their room a lot and they're not talking, or they're not smiling. They're not happy. They don't want to go to school. Maybe they're complaining of stomach aches, headaches. They're finding different reasons not to be there. Maybe they're in the nurse's office a lot, you know, not wanting to be in the classroom. Another big one is a major drop in grades. A lot of times when I see these victims, I mean, they go from being honor students to getting D's and F's. I've seen it. And so, and then, you know, sometimes there's eating issues, sleeping issues. So you want to look for anything that's abnormal. So anything that your child is doing differently, you're going to want to look at that. Mm-hmm. So it could be physical symptoms, emotional symptoms, social symptoms. I mean, that they could go from wanting to be engaged and have conversation with people to not wanting to have any conversation at all. Now, some children are really good about vocalizing the bullying. Mm-hmm. You know, they will happen for a couple weeks, maybe, or days, and they'll vocalize it right away. But so, you know, that's a little bit more obvious and you can intervene sooner. But usually it takes a lot longer for it to come out. And unfortunately, when it does come out, it usually comes out really drastically to where these victims are usually suicidal, you know, or they're really, really down and out by the time all it comes out.
So again, I guess what you're saying is just be communicative, engage with your child, observe, be, you know, the communication seems to be like the key. Just, you know, ask your child how the day went and, you know, maybe draw them out if they're not, you know, they say fine, you know, and then just there's a, you know, a long pause and then, you know, maybe draw them out some more, huh?
Yeah, and I always say parents know their children best. So like I said, anything that they're doing that they don't normally do, you're going to want to be alert to that. So you just want to be observant. You know, you just want to be observant in anything they do different. You know, so some kids, maybe they just are, they pick at their food and they don't eat. So that's not anything unusual, you know. So, but if they're doing something opposite where they just can't stop eating or something different, I mean, anything that's out of their norm, that's what you're going to want to be alerted to.
Okay. All right. So one of the hardest things we have to do as parents is to deal with the death of a pet, you know, or a family member or a friend. How do we explain that to small children?
You know, with younger ones, Circe, what I find that works a little bit better, not that, because I think even adults have a difficult time understanding death. But, you know, when you're dealing with little ones, I find that doing it through books, little kid-friendly books, helps, you know, when we're talking more like the early elementary years or the toddler years, I you know, I think they're not really aware, and you can do it in the best kid friendliest manner and just kind of talking with them and verbalizing it, you know, that, you know, some, you know, the animal's gone or the family member's gone. I don't think they'll really truly understand it. But I think when they're toddlers, you're planting seeds. And so you're prepping them for as they get a little bit older. So it's just good for them just to hear that language. But the early elementary, I find that doing it through books is really good, and drawings. Through books and drawings is really good. And as they get a little bit older, then just having that conversation with them. And then it depends on the family's beliefs. So, you know, if there's spiritual beliefs in that family, then, you know, you're going to want to, you know, bring in your spiritual beliefs or whatever those family's beliefs are. You're going to want to, you know, bring that in to draw them in. But again, the things that I recommend are not rocket science. It's the good old fashioned communication, however you can do that, whether you do that verbally or you do that through drawing or through reading, or maybe even videos. You know, sometimes there's some good videos out there, you know, with technology that you can use.
Okay. Well, staying on that same vein, how do we explain the suicide of a family member or a friend to children of any age?
That's a hard one, especially the younger ones, because I don't necessarily know if they truly understand suicide. I think it's funny. I think at a certain age they do, because, you know, I've had in the ER, I've actually had little 5-year-olds that have come in and they said they were suicidal. So they didn't exactly know what suicide meant, but they knew that it was something that was serious, and they knew that if they did that, they were going to get some sort of attention for whatever they, you know, whatever reason that was. So they didn't fully grasp it, but they knew it was something serious. So in the younger years, you know, I don't really recommend that you use that word. I mean, you use that, you know, let them know that that family member is gone. And then when they're more at a little bit, you know, older age where they can really understand what that actually means, that's where I think you talk to them about that. And you let them know that it wasn't that you were keeping that information from them. It was just that you knew that they wouldn't have fully understood it. And then, so then you let them know that now you're older, and I think now you would understand, you know, what that is and what that means. And then you talk to them about suicide, and then about that individual and who, what they might have been feeling and what leads to the suicide.
Mm-hmm. I know in New Mexico, and it's probably true for other states, there are grief centers, some specifically for children experiencing grief and some treating entire families or adults. I know your family has used the services of a grief center. What kind of services did the New Mexico Grief Center offer? And what can one expect if one goes to a grief center?
Well, you know, Cersei, we're still very much part of the New Mexico Grief Center. And when we joined it 10 years ago, it actually was only specifically for children. So when we joined it, it was Children's Grief Center. But now it is known as the New Mexico Grief Center, where they're also involving adults now. So grieving adults are free to go there now. But what you can expect from a grief center, honestly, is unity. One thing I think that my son and I, you know, got out of it, and why we have been a part of the grief center all of these last 10 years, is the other people around us have experienced something very similar to us. And there's something very healing about that. And I can't, you know, fully explain the depths of, you know, what that does. But you can experience that unity by, you know, being able to be around others that have gone through it. And you do that in primarily in group settings. And one thing I also, at grief centers, which you'll be able to experience, is you'll see that you're allowed to grieve that individual. People listen to you. You can do it in so many ways. You can verbalize it. You do it also in projects. There's a lot of different things you can do. Like you can make things, you know, at the grief center. You can also, there's healing garden where you get to honor your family members, where you might be able to plant something or grow something. And then if you stay at the grief center, you can actually watch those things, you know, bloom and develop. And I think it's very symbolic, you know, to do those things. So, and there's also even they have libraries, libraries of books and information that's free. They have free resources that you can take them with you and, you know, read them. And it's all about grief and bereavement and stories. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a lot of resources there, so you don't feel so alone.
Right. So it sounds like it's a community that has banded together around grief, and it's healing each other together in different ways. And so you don't feel alone. Besides grief centers, what other resources are there for parents who are concerned about their children, especially in dealing with grief or depression or bullying? I know we've talked about libraries and online videos, but what other resources are out there to help parents or their children in dealing with these complicated topics?
You know, I think seeking professional resources, you know, like therapists or psychologists, that's going to be, you know, parents' best bet is to get to their children those sorts of therapies. And whether they do that, you know, on a one-on-one individual based, or whether they do that, sometimes other therapy centers offer groups. So sometimes they can do it in a group way. And there's also something that I don't know if I've ever talked about on one of the podcasts, but there's a therapy that we call multisystemic in-home family therapy. And so this is where a therapist actually comes into the home and works with the child or children, if there's more than one, and their families. And they deal with them in the home environment, and they're able to talk about it. And you know, deal with it in that sense. And then there's other types of therapies out there, like equine therapy, where kids can work with horses, and there's play therapy, and there's even therapies where kids can work with animals. Mm-hmm. So there's just different type of therapies where kids can, or even teens or adolescents can, release all their emotions about grief and bereavement in just different ways.
Mm-hmm. I have a different question now. Many people want to help and be helpful when they see a child struggling. But what do you do if that helpful person tells your child something that you totally don't believe in? You know, I remember years ago when I was teaching at a private school, I had a student whose parents were getting divorced, and he was really struggling with that. And one day the religious education teacher told the entire class that divorce was a sin and anyone who was divorced was a sinner. And that fourth grader, who was already upset by his parents' divorce, then got really worried about what his teacher was saying. So how do you, for the lack of a better word, do damage control after someone has said something that's hard to walk back?
Yeah, that's a tough one, Cersei. That's a really tough one. I think what you explain to them is that there's a lot of different opinions out there, and there's a lot of different personalities and reasons for that. And you just need to let them know that whatever your own belief systems are within your family, and that's going to be what really matters to them. And I mean, there have been situations where, you know, I've recommended though to parents or families or the caregivers, whoever's raising them, is that the right environment for your child? And I mean, sometimes there's not a lot of options. You know, you could be in a rural area or an area where you just can't pick up and leave, and transitions aren't easy anyway. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think it's just depending on that situation. You really need to reinforce that, you know, just because someone else believes certain things, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's what your own family's beliefs are, and really focus in on that. And if you're able, then, you know, you may need to consider that that might not be the right environment for them.
Right. Okay. So when my husband was in the military and the kids were little, the Gulf War broke out. So that was years ago. And of course, naturally, we had the news on 24 hours a day. It seemed like it was 24 hours a day. And I didn't realize that my kids were also binge watching the news with me, especially our 4-year-old. And then when his dad deployed later, my son had nightmares and separation anxiety. And I had no idea that the news I was watching, I didn't even notice he was around, and how that was affecting him. So there have been so many horrible events on the news lately, you know, school shootings, the war, you know, transportation accidents. If your child has seen something like that on TV and comes to you with questions, and what should you say? And especially if they're really concerned about what they've seen on TV.
Well, I think if they've seen it, I think then you need to address it. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't avoid it. So I think the worst thing you could do is avoid it or deter it or try to, you know, say that it didn't happen or disregard, you know, whatever they saw. So I think, you know, once they do see it, you're going to need to address it. But I think, and in the most, again, you want to do these things in the most kid-friendly manner that you can do it. And depending on their developmental level, you know, wherever stage they're at. But then going forward, then I think you definitely need to be very conscious of what they're watching, what they're seeing, what they're observing. I think this may sound twisted, but in some sense, it's good that sometimes kids see this, because that's the reality. You know, you can't put them in a bubble, because sometimes then when they do, if they see it when they're much older, then it's totally overwhelming and they don't have any kind of skill set to deal with it. So I think as they develop through the years, that having some exposure to this is healthy because it teaches them how to deal with it, you know, as they get older, because they're going to deal with it as they get older. But again, you want to do all of that within reason, and you don't want it to be totally overwhelming. So I think, like I said, in the future, you do need to be conscious of it, and, you know, give it to them in, you know, as many small amount of doses, if you're able to do that. Mm-hmm. I know in this day and age, it's a lot more difficult, just with cell phones and social media, and it's a lot harder to do that. But yeah, if you can do any kind of boundary setting with that, then you need to do that. But yeah, once it's out there, you need to talk to them about it.
I know that Mr. Rogers is famously reported saying, you know, in really bad situations, look for the helpers, you know. And he did a show on, you know, there are people helping, there are good people out there, you know. And so as parents, when we see bad things on TV, should we also tell the kids that, but look at all the first responders, look at the people helping, look at the neighborhoods coming together, or is that not helpful?
No, I think it is, because I think it's, you know, points out to children that even through the worst of situations and through tragedy, there's goodness, you know, and it's good for them to know that that's out there, and it gives them hope, you know, that in this world that there's a balance, you know, with that good and that bad. So no, I think it is definitely very helpful to let them know that that there those support systems are out there.
Yeah, I believe it takes a village to raise a child. And, you know, outside of the immediate family, like parents and grandparents and, you know, the schools and what, where are some other good non-medical resources to get help or guidance on how to handle some of life's more challenging situations? I know we talked about the internet and films, and the internet's always available, but you have to be careful. What other human resources do you think parents might consider when trying to navigate life?
Yeah, you know, I think that depending on the other people around you, you're right. It takes a community. It takes a village to, I always say my children are being raised generationally from all sorts of people. But I mean, I think whatever you're involved in your community, you know, if you are involved in churches or any kind of spiritual community, I think those are definitely good resources. Clergy members or even other people, you know, in your parishes or, you know, that are involved with you, good role models, basically, around, you know, your children. And also, you know, depending on your school system, how connected you are and, the, you know, even like the different organizations like the Boys and the Girls Club and even organized sports, you know, sometimes coaches and, you know, if you've got them in all, you know, different activities, you know, those people can be good resources as well. You know, and just, you know, maybe people, just even a neighbor, you know, good old fashioned neighbors who are good role models, you know, gravitate towards those individuals. And I think just their modeling, you know, would be good. Cause as we know, kids, sometimes when they hear things from you, it doesn't sound as magical and as wonderful if it came from someone else. So,
oh, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah, my kids, seriously, if you said something, my kids would think it was absolutely the most amazing advice ever in the world. And if I said it, they'd be like, Mom, you don't know what you're talking about. So,
well, that's true. And, you know, we all, if we sat and thought about it, we know so many people who are subject matter experts. You know, if we include our children in some of our grown-up activities, they start meeting interesting people who will be good role models, but will teach them things, you know, take them to the library. I used to go to the library, and the librarian was the smartest person I knew and could fix any sort of, had advice for anything, could fix any sort of situation, could recommend the right book for me. And so I think there's a lot of people out there that we could, you know, expose our children to that will help them grow you know, that we may not be thinking about, you know. So I think that's good advice.
Yeah, you know, one other group I didn't mention is youth groups. Youth groups are really good,
Yeah.
especially when they're family run. You know, we joined a youth group and it's been the best decision ever because all of those other families or the parents and the people involved in that youth group are, they're really good models. And then also the other youth in that group are doing a lot of things that are very similar to what my children are doing and have the same values and same belief systems. So that's another good, you know, thing to mention for, you know, when you want to reach out and get that sort of support.
Well, Natalie, you've given our listeners some good information, and I appreciate your coming to speak to us. It's always nice to hear other parents' perspectives and to you know, feel like there are resources out there. And so I wanted to thank you for coming on the show today.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's a really, I love the museum and the Military Collaborative is a, it's been a really wonderful organization to be a part of. And yeah, it's great. It's great.
Well, as always, I would like to remind our listeners that this podcast has been brought to you by the Museum of the American Military Family and Learning Center and the Veteran Family Community Collaborative. And the museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brats Seal and Military Brats Registry. And we've been talking with Dr. Natalie Williamson today. She works for the public school system and is a psychologist and a mom and part of the collaborative. So thanks a lot once again, Natalie.
Yeah, thanks.